thanks for tuning in to Taste Radio, the number one podcast for the food and beverage industry. I'm producer and host Ray Lateef, and you're listening to episode 215, which features an interview with plant-based food pioneer Brendan Brazier, the co-founder of protein platform Vega and Pulp Culture, an innovative brand of adult juice beverages. Just a reminder, if you like what you hear on Taste Radio, please share the podcast with friends and colleagues. And of course, we'd love it if you could review us on the Apple Podcasts app or your listening platform of choice. In recent years, few trends have impacted the landscape of food and beverage as significantly as that of plant-based diets. Things were certainly different in 2004, when there were just a handful of brands that were focused on and promoted plant-based products. One of those was Vega, an ahead-of-its-time brand of protein powders made with vegetable-based ingredients. Brendan Brazier, an endurance athlete and expert in plant-based nutrition, co-founded Vega and was the original formulator of its products. A decade after it launched, and amid a growing number of consumers adopting plant-focused eating habits, Vega had become one of the leading brands in the fast-growing business of nutritional powders and bars. And in 2015, the company was acquired by White Wave Foods for $550 million. Last year, Brendan rekindled his entrepreneurial spirit as the co-founder of Pulp Culture, a first-of-its-kind brand of fermented cold-pressed juices anchored in the emerging business of better-for-you booze. In the following interview, I spoke with Brendan about the roots of his passion for plant-based foods and how it culminated in Vega, why the brand's heavy investment in consumer education paid off, the reason he launched Pulp Culture despite avoiding alcohol for 14 years, and how he's drawing upon lessons from building Vega to support the brand's development, and also offers his perspective on the evolution of plant-based foods. Hey folks, it's Ray with Taste Radio. I'm going to call right now with Brendan Brazier, the co-founder of Vega and Pulp Culture. Brendan, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. You know, I wonder about your routine, your daily routine, because you have been known for a long time as an endurance athlete, and I have not been known as anything close to an endurance athlete. So when I wake up in the morning, I have my little daily routine, which is usually a cup of coffee, throw some water on my face, and then get down to my office and start working. I assume yours is a little different.
Yeah, that doesn't sound bad either, though. That's a pretty good routine. I certainly don't have anything super structured. When I was racing full-time years ago, I mean, it's been 15 years now since I've raced full-time. And yeah, I was pretty regimented then. I had very much a structured program. You know, every minute of the day was accounted for. Now it's not like that as much. You know, I like things, I like little flexibility. I like to keep some variety in the day. Keep it, you know, some surprises in there too. I don't want to make it like a template where everything is predictable and exactly the same anymore, just for a change. And I think mentally it's kind of nice to just kind of have a bit of flow and a bit of flux in the day. So yeah, I'm not on a super tight regimen now. You know, I just know what works well for me. And right now, sort of a little less structure is helpful, I think.
Do you drink coffee?
Once in a while, before a workout. I can certainly not drink it if I'm not going to be doing a pretty intense workout, because I just get too jittery, and I find it really affects me quite a lot. I certainly can't drink it for more than one day in a row. Like, you know, I could maybe have two cups a week max, but yeah, I find I'm quite sensitive to it, and it does help with workouts for sure. Like there's, you know, that's been proven in science, and I can also speak to that just from personal experience. But yeah, you pay a price, you know, you fry your adrenals. It's kind of like borrowing energy. You know, you get energy from the future, basically, that you have to pay back, and you get it now, which can be helpful, like you say, for workouts, but it's tough on the adrenals.
You were way ahead of the game on plant-based foods. Tell me about your initial interest in that type of diet.
Yeah, well, it started when I was around 15, so in 1990, and it was really just me trying to find food that would help me feel good. And I'd started training full-time back then. My goal was to be a professional athlete. I just thought that would be an amazing career to be able to have. So I really started taking it seriously, you know, before, I guess it wasn't full-time because I was still going to school then, but it was, I trained before school and then twice after school. So it kind of felt like full-time, but that's where my focus was for sure. And I tried a whole bunch of different ways of eating to speed recovery because I knew that if I could recover more quickly, I could do more training in less time, which would mean I would improve in less time. So yeah, I became obsessed with trying to get my body to rebuild and regenerate after exercise. So tried a whole bunch of different ways of eating and eventually settled on plant-based. And at first it didn't work great for me. I was often hungry and tired and fatigued, didn't feel great, but I was doing it wrong. I was, you know, making common mistakes, eating tons of carbs, lots of pasta and refined foods, and really not very many nutrient-dense foods. So obviously back then in 1990, there weren't a lot of options for athletes and not a lot of information either. It was very hard to find information, you know, go to the library as opposed to now you just Google something. So it was slow. It took me a while to figure it out, but I kept a really good training log and nutrition journal, and I could see the correlation when I was feeling good, when I was training well, when my results were getting better. I started to see a pattern in what I was eating, and when I ate more plant-based, I performed better and I felt better. So I really started to go that route and then just found plant-based sources for things that I thought I was lacking based on some of the limited research I had done at the time. So complete protein, vitamin B12, iron, calcium, omega-3 fats. Found sources for each of those from plants, blended them together and had a blender drink every day. And, you know, it didn't taste very good. It was just function. It was all about function back then. And it worked, you know, I would improve more quickly than I had in the past. And I just stuck with it. And then people started asking me what I was doing because I was improving more quickly than most people. And it was really just attention to detail and nutrition. It was that simple. And that's really what my first book was based on, was really just frequently asked questions put into book form that I talked about a nutrition program that I found that worked really well for me, that kind of evolved as I went along.
And the name of that nutrition program is?
So the book is called Thrive, and that came out, I did a self-published version in 2004, and then it was published by Penguin in 2007. Yeah. And basically it just outlines my nutritional philosophy. I talk about high net gain nutrition. I talk a lot about hormonal health too, which different adaptogens can help with lower cortisol, which means you sleep more deeply. So you wake up and you're fresh and you're rested and you actually don't crave coffee or sugar. So you've treated the cause of fatigue. You don't have to treat the symptom, things like that. So it's more long-term. It's certainly not a quick fix. It's more of a lifestyle for sure than it is a diet. So yeah, that's kind of how that happened. And of course, the nutritional philosophy that I used and put in the book is reflected in Vega and how that started when we basically took the blender drink I was making and made a commercial version, which is now called Vega One. And it's been out almost 16 years now. So it's, you know, it's been a while.
It's truly amazing to see how Vega has evolved on the market since it launched in 2004. And more so, how plant-based eating has evolved in that time as well. Did you anticipate the emergence of plant-based food as a macro trend, or did you see it initially as being a specialized diet that would appeal to a select few folks?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. You know, in the early days, I certainly didn't think beyond myself. It was really a very selfish endeavor, to be honest. I just wanted to perform well. But then, of course, I learned about the environmental impact of eating more plant-based and cutting animal products out, the social benefits of that as well, of course, and the health benefits. You know, in the U.S. and Canada and other parts of the world, human health is declining. We're overfed yet undernourished, which would have been a paradox in the past. You know, food used to be synonymous with nutrition. The more we ate, the better nourished we became. But the modern industrial food system has really in some cases, depleted food of nutrition, which seems like a strange thing, but food ought to be made up with vitamins, minerals, phytochemicals, antioxidants. And, you know, today it's not always a guarantee that it is. Often it's just basically refined, starchy food. You know, I could theorize back then that obviously, you know, human health and environmental health, food production, fixing both those things are huge issues. And doing it with a plant-based diet, just eating more plants, producing more plants as opposed to animals, is going to solve both those problems. So it was certainly my hope that at some point it would catch on. And I do think we're at that point. You know, you've got films like Game Changers and obviously all that's going on in the world today. People are looking at other ways of feeding themselves and you know, concerned about the environment, concerned about their own health and so on. So yeah, it's the last 3 years in particular has really been, you know, it's felt like things have really started to fall into place. So it's great to see.
When Vega made its debut, how was the brand received, particularly among athletes like yourself? I mean, were those the consumers that you were initially going after?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because I would go around to a lot of whole food stores and little tiny health food stores in Canada and talk to, you know, 10, 15 people, sometimes four people, like very, very small numbers. So it was slow. You know, it took a while because it was different. It was new. And back in the day, it was $75 for one tub, which was only 15 servings as well, if you can believe that. So people had to really buy that and then rebuy it because it usually took 3 weeks before people would actually feel better. So they had to buy this expensive thing that didn't taste very good and then rebuy it before they noticed any benefit. So as you can imagine, you know, it was kind of a hard thing to get going. But when people actually understood it, and you know, if they took the time to read my book or listen to one of my talks, they understood why that could be helpful and how it could help them have more energy and feel better and help them with focus and sleep quality and get leaner and so on. So when they tried it, it worked, and then they felt great, and other people would notice and say, hey, you know, you're looking good. What are you doing? And then they talk about Vega. So it spread that way. But yeah, it took a while for sure. And I think, you know, being an Ironman athlete, coming off 7 years of full-time racing, going straight into trying to build a brand was actually the best training for me, because Ironman training is, it's just about slogging it out. You know, it's just about showing up. And some days you don't feel great. And in fact, most of the time you're tired, which is the whole point. That's what training is for. It's to tire you out. And if you're not tired, you haven't trained enough. So going with that mentality into trying to build a brand was really a perfect storm. Like it had me in the right mental space to know that I'm about to do something it's going to be hard. I'm going to be tired most of the time. And it's gonna be an uphill battle. But I can deal with that. So bring it on. So it actually worked out really well that way. The way it just sort of flowed from full-time Ironman racing into full-time, you know, brand building, essentially.
Vega worked as a functional product. At the time in 2004, you mentioned this, great taste was a luxury attribute for protein-centric products. You, as the formulator, achieved eventually better taste. How do you get to that balance of taste and function?
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's an interesting question too. It's because, yeah, in the beginning, from day one, I mean, it was all function. Like I didn't consider taste at all, or even texture for that matter, when I was making for myself. Like it was clumpy and gritty and would settle to the bottom and stuff. And for me, I didn't care. Like that was, you know, I was all about the function. But then of course, yeah, as a commercial product, you know, people can't gag when they're drinking it. So, you know, there has to be this kind of evolution there. And, you know, luckily we haven't had to compromise in formulation or function because technology has improved. Like flavor technology has improved, you know, the ability to take food and mill it more finely and extract oils that are very flavorful, better than was available 16 years ago. And like I say, milling technology is a huge one. So it's far smoother now and dissolves better. Like even spray drying technology that has allowed us to do that and just make it really smooth has really, yeah, come a long way. So yeah, the great thing is there hasn't had to be a compromise just because technology has improved, mechanical technology of preparing it. So that's kind of a nice type of food technology that has helped us get both that way.
How long did it take before you were comfortable with the flavor?
Me personally, or
yeah,
for...
well, you and your consumers, and by your consumers I mean new consumers who started to buy Vega because they realized they didn't need to gag to drink your product.
Yeah, well, you know, really the first several years it was pretty hardcore. You had to recognize that it was going to work and that you're going to get benefits. And I think there's almost like a badge of honor. Like I actually think some of the early Vega consumers, and they, you know, still around today, I think it was sort of like a club. You know, you join the club, it doesn't taste good, but hey, if you can stick with it, you're going to feel great. Your skin's going to clear up. You're going to be at the top of your game. So it was almost like a pride thing, I think. And now, you know, it that sort of removed. And I actually kind of like those days. Like I like the fact that it was the way it was. It was so primitive that way. And now, you know, it's mainstream, right? It's in Costco and Walmart and Target and all these places, which is great. I mean, that's the intention is to get more good, high quality plant-based foods to more people at a lower cost. And those things have happened. So that's, you know, the evolution that we've wanted. But personally, you know, I kind of liked it when it was kind of like dirt myself. Like it felt like it was doing you more good. Whereas now it's almost like a treat. I mean, it tastes pretty conventional, which is great. Like I say, I mean, that's the plan, right? We want people to have better plant-based options, even if they're not as committed to drinking stuff that doesn't taste good. It should be for everyone. It shouldn't just be for those who are willing to put up with that. So that's where the real change comes from. You know, then like Beyond Meat's done amazing with that. Like, you know, they've made this amazing tasting product. So that's where the real change comes when meat eaters start eating Beyond Meat because they feel better after than if they were to eat animal meat. So, you know, like I get it. That's if you really want to make changes in the world, that's what you got to do. And so that's what we're doing.
Did you have a sustainable business with those hardcore consumers that you were talking about? Or did you really need to change what Vega was all about from a texture and flavor perspective to achieve the real kind of revenue and profitability that you wanted, you and your co-founder?
Yeah, well, it's like we could have had a really, you know, just kept it small, kept it tight, kept that club alive that, you know, actually enjoys drinking things that are sometimes hard to drink. And yeah, no, I think there absolutely could be a profitable business around that. But we had, you know, we got to the point where we had to decide, like, what is our goal here? Like, why are we doing what we're doing? Is it to kind of have this sort of inner circle group of folks? Or is it to try and make a change and to try and get more high quality plant-based foods that are very nutritious out to a broader group of people? And of course, then the volume increases, the cost comes down, it's more accessible. And that's where the real change comes from. And, you know, that's what we decided. That's what we want to do. That's why we commercialized it in the first place, is to make a change, not to just sort of indulge ourselves in it. But that can work too. You know, like it was just, there's not one right or wrong. I think you can definitely have a sustainable business and keep it tight that way. You don't have to always go more mainstream. But then, of course, you know, there's pros and cons to both.
You talked earlier about education. There's a lot of education getting folks to understand the benefits of a plant-based diet, of plant-based protein, of Vega. There's also the element of competition because there's plenty of protein powders out there. How much education did it take and how much do you have to convince consumers to buy your product versus conventional ones?
We always said, like back in the early days, like Vega was part education company, part product company. Like the education wing of Vega, we talked about that being the why, and then Vega was the how. It was very much education focused because we really felt that a consumer who knows more will buy Vega. Like we were that confident in the product. So like we just had this saying, it's like ignorance is our only competition. Like obviously sounds super arrogant and cocky, but the idea was that, you know, if the consumer knows more, he or she is going to be more likely to buy Vega. Therefore, it's in our best interest to put out, you know, factually based information and do it in an entertaining, fun way. We actually made a whole video series called Thrive Forward that was free to everyone. It had all these videos and PDF downloads. There are recipes and meal plans and all types of good content to help people eat more plant-based foods and transition to it and make it part of their lifestyle. So we really focused on that and didn't really look at like product competition. I mean, sure, there's some other products out there now. You know, there's some really great plant-based products out there. It's come a long way. Like back in the day, it was really, you know, there was Vega and it was really whey-based products that we're competing with. And now, you know, there are a lot of great plant-based ones. And, you know, I'm about the mission. Like if people are eating plant-based products, I'm happy. Like it doesn't have to be Vega. Vega was just one of the ways to get people thinking about fueling with plants as opposed to animal products. So I'm just happy to see where the industry's gone. And, you know, those companies that bring new innovation to plant-based, I'm really grateful to them because that's what we want, right? We want to be competitive, but we want then others to say, hey, we can compete here too. And then that's great. You know, it pushes it forward for everyone. Then there are other companies that have the business model, just like make a knockoff, don't educate, and just try and skim off the companies that are you know, putting the work out there. Don't love that as much, but I get it too. You know, it's business and that's some business models and that's just kind of the way it works. And as long as it's plants, I'm happy with that.
That's pretty expensive to have two units within a company, one focused on education and one focused on the product itself. How much of the education wing, we'll call it, contributed to overall costs early on?
I don't know as a percentage. It was quite considerable. But of course, we looked at it as an investment. You know, we didn't look at it as a loss. And of course, when we started in the US, we started the company in Canada. So Vancouver, it got going there first and kind of spread across Canada to Toronto, another big market. But yeah, the US for the longest time, we were losing money, but we didn't look at it that way. We looked at it as investment, you know, to get market share and educate people. And then our thesis was, or hope at least, it was that, you know, at one point that would flip and we would have reached a critical mass and enough folks would be educated well enough and understand the benefits of plant-based nutrition and therefore Vega and try it and see the results and keep buying it and be repeat buyers and talk about it, that eventually that would flip. And it did. You know, it took a while. It took, like I say, I mean, we're in year 16 now. You know, this is not a new company. So I think it took, you know, it took 7 or 8 years. It was not quick. But then, of course, the benefit to that is then, you know, you own that space. Like, you're known in that category, like as a category leader. And that's the reward, but the cost is pretty great. So yeah, it just depends what type of business you want to build.
You must have had some pretty patient investors.
Well, that was a great thing is we didn't have any. It was just myself and Charles. You know, we didn't take in any investment until year 7. And VMG, if you're familiar with them, but mm-hmm, amazing group of folks in the Bay Area and Southern California. They were our only investors, came in at year 7. We sold the company at year 11, and they were phenomenal. So couldn't have asked for better partners there. But yeah, before that, it was just myself and Charles.
When did you realize that the brand was really hitting its stride? How did you define those metrics for saying, okay, this is now a brand with a lot of potential to be an iconic mainstream brand?
You know, it was such a slow burn. Like, there wasn't one moment where it's like, oh, okay, this is flipped. It was so slow over many, many years. You know, when I would start to go to some of the bigger Whole Foods in the US, like in New York, for example, like Columbus Circle, seeing end caps there, Union Square, I know the big New York stores that I would go to 4, sometimes 5 times a year visit. Yeah, when I started to see that, and then people in New York, for example, which is a long way from Vancouver, just walking up and picking it up off the shelf and, you know, going up and talking to them and saying, hey, you know, you just walked in and picked that up. Why? And then they would tell a story, usually about a friend who they'd heard about it from, who started using it and it helped that person feel good and feel better. And it's kind of spread that way. So a lot of it was word of mouth because it really did work, right? It really does work. It's just takes time. And sometimes, as you know, of course, you know, people want quick fixes, and this is not that. We're like, we don't pretend it is.
Let's talk a bit about your new company, Pulp Culture, which is really interesting to me because when I found out you were involved in the brand, frankly, I was a little surprised given your history of nutrition, balance, the fact that you're an endurance athlete. And I did learn that you weren't a consumer of alcoholic beverages for a very long time. What drew you to Pulp Culture? What drew you to the brand?
Well, that's good. That's the right reaction to have because that's the reaction I had myself. It's like if someone had said even 2 years ago, your next business is going to be in the alcoholic beverage space, I would not have believed you. Like it just not at all. And you're absolutely right. Like I had not had an alcoholic drink in 14 years. And I was in Whole Foods, in the Venice Whole Foods. And I saw a can of 101 cider. And I just picked it up and I looked at it and it had one ingredient, apples, not even water, just apples. And I thought, how is that possible? Zero sugar, it says right on there. It's probiotic and it is one ingredient. I didn't understand that. So first time I've ever done this, I actually reached out to a company after seeing something on the shelf, totally blind, knew nothing about the company or the founder, emailed info@101cider.com. Mark responds 20 minutes later. He's like, hey, yeah, I know of you from Canada and Vega, and I'm in the fitness industry, and I used to live in Canada. And so we met up and became friends, and he explained fermentation to me. He explained how when you let fresh juice sit, it ferments. It's just ambient bacteria that basically eats all the sugar, turns that into probiotics and organic acids, and what we call full spectrum alcohol. It's the whole outcome of fermentation. It's not just alcohol. Like, that's just one of the things. So I thought, how bad can it be to drink a fermented apple? Like, it can't be that bad for you. So I tried it, and it felt great. It's super clean, helped with digestion. I felt focused. I felt really good. I went to the gym an hour and a half later, no hangover whatsoever, no dehydration, but felt really good. Like, it just kind of took the edge off, just felt focused and productive and calm, almost like a nootropic. Like, I actually started using it as a way to focus on work and emails. I would sit there and I'd drink some and I would crush a whole bunch of emails and get through stuff. And, you know, 2 hours later, I'm like, wow, I just got a ton of work done. So that was the introduction to me. And then, so like I say, Mark and I became friends and then business partners. I invested in 101. I just think it's such a great concept. And I just love the simplicity and the elegance of the solution. While, you know, folks are trying to make hangover cure pills and labs and stuff, just ferment juice. And it's so simple. And he got the idea in the Basque region, northern Spain, and then brought it back to the US and put kind of an American California spin on it, put it in cans. And I thought it was just brilliant. I thought it was just so smart, because a lot of people don't realize, and I didn't at all at the time, Mark's taught me a ton about alcoholic beverages and how they're made. And alcohol is isolated and it's distilled, obviously, in spirits, and beer has its own process, and it's, and hard seltzer, like, which is malt liquor, you know, it's very harsh process of making alcohol, unless you do it this way, which is so simple. So I love that. I just thought it was, again, the simplicity really appealed to me. So then we partnered and created Pulp Culture together, which is the same base, that wild fermented full spectrum fermented juice. And then we blend in fermented super fruits for nutrition, obviously, and botanical adaptogens. So it's not only not bad for you, like a lot of alcohols are bad for you, obviously. This is not only not bad, it's actually good for you. So I thought that was really cool. And the fact that all the people I know are label readers, they will not eat food if they don't understand what every ingredient is, where it came from, how it's processed. And I'm that. I've been that for, you know, most of my life. So I thought, why is it that people will then totally disregard that standard when it comes to drinking alcoholic beverages? Why will they then drink these things that are really not good and, you know, just at least not bad? Like, people will drink, you know, vodka and soda or whatever, things that are in their mind less bad. So our goal, of course, was to raise the standard of quality of alcoholic beverages. And so that's what Pulp Culture is.
I was chuckling there when you said it didn't give you a hangover. I'm trying to think about if you've ever had a hangover in your life.
And oh, sure. I mean, back, like, you know, in my early 20s and stuff, a bunch of us, like, when we, you know, I had roommates and stuff, we were training full time. But, you know, you 21, 22, and that's just part of it, right? You train hard, but you also go to these parties and things, and then you don't feel good the next day. And you learn pretty quick that that's just not something that you want in your life.
Some people learn it faster than others.
That's true. That's true for most things.
In our industry, when I'm talking to early stage entrepreneurs, one of the first questions I always ask is, you know, what's your reason for being? Why do you exist on the market? And I'm sure you get this question all the time. Why not just drink a cold pressed juice and have a traditional alcoholic drink separately? You know, isn't this idea of a better for you alcoholic beverage kind of an oxymoron?
Well, I love that you brought that up. And again, like, similar to Vega, you know, there's that education that we need to do, which is, you know, the challenge, but also the opportunity. So creating a category, the hard-pressed juice category, we're going to get a lot of questions. And that's great. We love it because we love talking about it because we believe it's a better approach to quite a big problem. And yeah, you know, it's interesting. Like, some people, they've asked us, they're like, so this is juice, like from juice press or whatever, and then you add alcohol. What type of alcohol do you add, like vodka? And so it's just helping them understand that we don't add alcohol. Like alcohol is just a natural byproduct of fermentation. So we don't actually, in our head, think of these as alcoholic beverages. We think of them as fermented beverages. Fermentation is a great process, right? It's a natural process. Kimchi, sauerkraut, these are all really healthy foods that have been eaten for centuries with different cultures that help with digestion and are just generally very good for you. So why not just ferment juice and also, you know, embrace the one of the other byproducts of fermentation being alcohol and have it as just a very healthy alcoholic beverage. So zero, again, zero sugar naturally, because it just eats all the sugar and you get 6 billion CFUs of probiotics. So like I say, with a meal too, and if you're athletic, your body is pretty tired after a workout. That's the whole point. Obviously, like I said before, you break down your body and it gets tired, as it should, and it rebuilds and it overcompensates. It becomes stronger than it was before. That's why training works. So if you can take digestive strain off your body, you will recover more quickly. So dinner, every dinner now, you know, I have a pulp culture because it helps with that digestion and that helps with recovery and that helps you feel better the next day too. So yeah, it's just a different approach, you know. It's, and again, this is not something I would have thought I would have gotten interested in even just a few years ago, but it really just makes so much sense. And I've, you know, lived the benefits. I feel, you know, I feel great.
There is a good amount of interest, consumer interest and demand in this quote unquote better for you alcoholic space. The fermented beverage category is also a growing space as well. How did you determine that going the alcoholic route was the best option for a brand? I mean, I assume that you could have removed alcohol from pulp culture and just had a non-alc beverage, right?
Well, it's interesting. And I wonder that myself too, but then that involves processing. It's quite a process to remove alcohol because when you ferment something, like it just, you get alcohol. That's just nature. So, I mean, there probably is a way to remove it, but, you know, that's kind of a whole different thing. And we figure too, you know, like White Claw, for example, hard seltzer, like good for those guys. You know, they've built an amazing brand, a very popular brand, and really help people to start thinking about drinking better and drinking things that are less bad for you. So we think that when consumers are ready for not just not bad for you, but actually good for you, then they're going to come over to us. Like, to be honest with you, I think we're a little early, kind of like with Vega. You know, there was no demand for hemp, pea, and rice protein in 2004. So we helped with the education around that and helped create that demand for it because we truly felt that those synergistic proteins together were better. And I think we've proven that to be true since, you know, 16 years later now. But I believe the same with this. I believe that fermented juice is just an expression of better. And again, coming back to the elegance of the solution, just the simplicity of just letting juice sit there in our tanks for 3 months. We make it all downtown Los Angeles too, by the way, and just have these huge tanks and it just sits there. You know, it's a new thing, so it's somewhat unknown, but that's our theory, is that when people are ready for alcoholic containing beverages that are actually good for them, we'll be there.
It's opportunity costs. You're deciding how and when to spend your time and resources. And, you know, you've been involved in other startups and made investments into other emerging brands. Is pulp culture similar or different in how you've assessed opportunities to invest, again, your money and time?
So if I invest in something, it's got to be trying to solve a problem. And the problems that I'm interested in trying to solve, one, the food system. Like, we all know that the current food system is not as good as it should be. Like, we ought to be getting more nutrition, vitamins, minerals, phytochemicals, antioxidants, while spending less of each natural resource, land, water, fossil fuel, like nutrient to resource ratio, I call that. So it has to have a very compelling story around how it helps environmentally and how it helps nutritionally, and that getting that ratio right. So spending less environmental resource while getting more of each nutritional component that we ought to be getting more of. So that's really what I look at. And pulp culture, of course, embrace that. And then founders too, of course. I mean, the founder has to be passionate, has to truly believe what he or she is doing is making a difference, has to be obsessive, to be honest, like really thinking about this 24/7, living and breathing it, and smart, ambitious, you know, just the things that you look for in a great business partner and entrepreneur, and also rounding out things that I'm not as good at. Like if I partnered with someone like Charles, for example, back in the early days of Vega, you know, he had skills that I certainly didn't have, and, you know, I had some that he didn't have. So we were very complementary. And I see that with Mark as well, with building out Pulp Culture. So picking your co-founders well, I guess, is also a very important thing. Just finding ones who are complementary and you're not kind of stepping on each other's toes, and, you know, just have the same kind of view of the world and grand vision and mission too. And I will mention too about Pulp Culture, like environmentally and 101 Cider, how something that really interested me, and Mark taught me this too, is so the base is apples. And apples, of course, grow on apple trees, and apple trees have a very deep root system that find groundwater. So the irrigation they need is minimal to zero. Whereas if you're growing barley or wheat or these types of crops to make beer, for example, they have a very short root system and it needs constant irrigation. So the amount of water consumed to make beer or kombucha, which is pretty much all water, or hard seltzer, anything else, uses far more water than what we use to make, you know, hard-pressed juice. And being a California company, we got to be mindful of that. We have to be conscious of our water use for sure. So another reason that I you know, really liked this approach.
Can you imagine ever having founded a company without a co-founder? Because this is your second one, and in each case, you've had a partner who you mentioned has a complementary skill set. Do you think you'd ever be able to go at it alone? And also, I talk to entrepreneurs who say, you know, I'd love it if I had a co-founder. How do you go about finding the right fit for someone that you're going to be working with potentially for a long time?
Yeah, I mean, you hear these horror stories of people starting businesses and having clashes and fighting over things and stuff. And I guess I've been lucky, but yeah, no, the value of your partner, your co-founder is, you know, can't be overstated. And no, to answer your question, like founding a company and doing it by myself, honestly, I don't think I have the ability, like just to be totally truthful. I have blind spots, but I think my advantage is I know I do. And, you know, there's some folks who don't know that they don't have the ability, but I think I know enough and I know myself well enough to be honest. And I don't think I have the ability to just found a company and completely do it all myself. There are shortcomings, and the only reason that I've been able to succeed is that I'm aware of those shortcomings and then, you know, find great partners to fill those. So I consider myself very lucky to, you know, to have had that support.
Now in your second startup, do you feel like it's a little bit easier given your background and history with Vega and the fact that you knew about being patient as an entrepreneur? I think that might be one of the hardest things in this business of CPG, is that it takes time to build things. Do you feel more comfortable? Do you feel more confident that Pulp Culture can be successful and potentially as successful as Vega?
Well, I do, because back in the day, you know, we had no connections. Charles and myself, we didn't know the industry. We knew no one. We just went at it blind. And I think that was part of the bit that I actually look back on with actually great fondness, because we didn't know how hard it would be. And if we had, we may not have started. Like, we kind of went blind. We just sort of walked into it. And then it's sort of like getting out on a long run. You know, you get out, you know, 20 miles and you realize you're out 20 miles from home, and, you know, you got to keep running. You can't stop. Like, you're out there now, kind of thing. So I look back on that as a really good learning lesson, but now we have contacts. You know, we know a lot of amazing people. We raised a strategic round last year, kind of the who's who of some CPG folks and amazing founders and great friends and just really good, smart people, which never would have been able to do had Vega not come first and having met some of these people. So I consider myself very fortunate to have this network now, and it's definitely easier than it was before. So yeah, I'm thankful for that.
What's the one mistake that you made with Vega that you promise that you're promising yourself you won't make with Pulp Culture?
I think actually it's a mistake that's very common, and I understand why it happens. But we definitely tried to expand geographically too quickly with Vega back in the early days. So being a high education product, we needed to be doing demos in stores and there talking to people, explaining the benefits, being very patient. And we went into regions because, so for example, Whole Foods is probably a lot of folks know, it's broken into regions. So we would do well in one region because we would have the team there. And then another region would see the sales and they're like, wow, these guys are really doing well. We got to bring this in. So it was hard to say no to purchase orders, but we should have, because we didn't have the ability to scale our education team to that new market. We had so few people involved and we didn't want to just hire demo companies, of course. I mean, you need to, like with this high touch type thing, you need to really treat it carefully. So we did that. We accepted orders that we probably shouldn't have in the beginning, but you see money coming in and you want to take it. And then a lot of the time in those new markets, without our high touch, our education teams, it just didn't do well. People didn't understand it, understandably. You know, it was more expensive and it didn't taste good. So that was a mistake we made, trying to go too fast geographically. So I think keeping it tight, like we've done with Pulp Culture, you know, it's available in all the Whole Foods in California now and BevMo. So we're starting with California. We'll move to Arizona and New York. You know, we'll go to other states where we feel we can allocate the team and get the education done there. Plus direct to consumer now, you know, we can do that with Pulp Culture because it's able to be sold direct to consumer, whereas hard seltzer, kombucha, beer is not due to liquor laws, but this is considered wine as a category because it's fermented juice. So we're able to sell direct, which is, you know, huge benefit too. So we can help educate through emails and education series that we can do, obviously, online.
You've been involved in the plant-based food business for a very long time, and there's a lot of folks that are thinking about the next evolution of this trend. We'll call it plant-based 2.0. How do you see the next decade playing out for plant-based food? You know, what will it entail, and how can brands best prepare for change?
Well, I think, you know, you look to companies like Beyond Meat. You know, I'm a huge fan of what they've done, what they continue to do. Ethan's a great friend. And, you know, I look to what they've done and the barriers that they faced in the beginning, you know, like wanting to put their product next to animal meat in supermarkets. That was just, people didn't get that. And Ethan really pushed for that because he knew that's where the change would come, is, you know, meat eaters eating plant-based for a change, not just making food for vegans. There's no change. There's no evolution that comes from that. So I think having that sort of attitude, like really mission-driven, really, really caring about your mission, not just seeing, hey, you know, this plant-based thing's hot, let's try and jump on that trend. If you can add something to it and evolve on something, whether it's through education, technology, science, a better product, then absolutely do it. But I would caution people who just see it as a business opportunity, as a growing trend to hop on. I don't think that's good for the industry as a whole. I think if you've got something really sincere and genuine to bring to it, absolutely, that's great. Then do it. But you know, I see these big companies now, they've let the small ones like Beyond Meat go and become big companies, but they look at them and they've kind of broken down the doors now. All these companies that it wasn't even on their scope or are seeing the market just dollars and cents, you know, they're just looking at it as a money thing. And so they want to get involved, which is also, you know, it's not all bad. It's good because there are now more plant-based options. But I would say to those new companies, just make sure it really is aligned with your personal values and your mission and be doing it for the right reason. It's going to make it so much easier to get up in the morning and go to work if you actually feel like you're making a difference and a change. If you're doing it just because you see this industry is hot, you want to get in, you want to get a piece of it, then, you know, it's going to be harder. It's like, I couldn't do that. I couldn't just go and start trying to sell something to what I saw as a hole in the market or whatever. But I guess in that sense, I'm not really a pure entrepreneur. I'm more of a mission-based entrepreneur who will just use entrepreneurship as a means to kind of nudge the world in the direction I feel it ought to go. So I guess that's kind of a difference too. Are you, like, knowing about yourself, are you using capitalism and entrepreneurship as an extension of your values and your worldview, or are you simply trying to fill a hole in the market and make some money? You know, not that one's good or bad. They're just different approaches, and just knowing which category you lie in, I think is helpful before starting a business.
Absolutely. And that's such great advice to anyone listening, whether they're a veteran entrepreneur or someone who's brand new to the industry. Brendan, it's been so great speaking with you. You have such a great perspective on our industry, and your career has been a real bright spot for folks who are trying to make a difference. And I congratulate you on Vega and wish you the best with Pulp Culture. It's a great product. I've had it a few times, and I think you've got a great runway for success.
Oh, thanks. I really appreciate that. And yeah, thanks for having me on, and thanks for spreading the word of entrepreneurship and startups and small business.
Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thanks.
That brings us to the end of episode 215. Thank you for listening, and thanks to our guest, Brendan Brazier. You can catch both Taste Radio and Taste Radio Insider on tasteradio.com, the Apple Podcasts app, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. As always, for questions, comments, ideas for future podcasts, please send us an email to ask@tasteradio.com. On behalf of the entire Taste Radio team, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.